second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota, Appley versus Kenesee Huber, appellant. For Mr. Huber, we have Mr. Michael Butler, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and also Mr. Clint Sargent, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Now, gentlemen, it's my understanding that Mr. Butler will open with 8 minutes, and then Mr. Sargent will speak for 12, and on the rebuttal, Mr. Butler will speak for 3, and Mr. Sargent for 7. Is that correct? Oh, all right. Well, as long as you've got it right, and it adds up to 20 minutes, we'll be fine. All right, and then for the state, we have Mr. Stephen Blair, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. And you'll be presenting this morning?
I will be.
Okay. There have been two disqualifications in this case. Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, former Justice of this court, to sit in Justice Meyer Henry's place, and Justice Severson has disqualified himself. And the court has appointed the Honorable Scott Myron, a circuit judge from the 5th Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Severson's place. So then, Mr. Sargent, you start.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court and counsel. I'm here today with Mr. Butler representing Kenneth Huber. Mr. Huber appeals his conviction for first-degree murder for the shooting of his wife on May 28, 2007, a shooting that Mr. Huber maintains was an accident. I'll start with a brief summary of the facts. On October 28, 2007, Ken Huber was at home lying in bed with his daughter, Stephanie. They were watching a movie together. It's the end of a long day where the family had spent some time with the grandparents. It was a good day. It had been a good day for the family. There hadn't been any arguments, any conflicts. Pam Huber came back to the bedroom that Ken and Stephanie were laying in. Ken got up, went out, grabbed a couple of cans of beer, came back. Stephanie testifies that Ken opened one of the beers, took a sip, laid back down, and then he got up and walked around the bed to the nightstand where he kept his service revolver. He had been in law enforcement for many years and had been the chief of police in Highmore for many years, and it was customary, she said, that he kept a loaded firearm by the side of the bed. She saw him get up.
Can I stop you just for a second? You called it a service revolver. I understand it's a semi-automatic block, isn't it? It's not a revolver.
Oh, excuse me. You're absolutely correct, Your Honor.
While I got you on the subject of the gun, the briefs refer to this weapon as having a tactical light on it in some places, and then there's some reference to it having a laser on it. So did this weapon have a flashlight that was attached to it so that it pointed in, that lighted the direction it was pointed? And or did it have a laser sight so that you could put a laser dot right on the place that the bullet's going to, I mean, assuming it's calibrated, the laser dot is going to hit the target?
The weapon had both. The flashlight also had a laser component to it. It ran on the underside of the handgun. You're absolutely correct. It was a semi-automatic Glock 40 caliber. And it did have a laser sight that, depending on how it was used, could be used to point to a target. Mr. Huber got up, walked around to the front of the bed, laid the handgun down on the bed, looked up in his closet, picked the gun back up, and then walked out into the hallway. Stephanie testifies during that whole time, Pam was awake, laying next to her, and her mother never said a thing, never acted like anything unusual was going on. Stephanie didn't think that anything unusual was going on. Her father went out into the hallway. She testified that she heard some clicking sounds, like he was manipulating the safe that was right outside the door. And then she says the next thing that she knows is she hears a gunshot and her father screaming, "Oh my God, oh my God," it was an accident. Now, the The jury trial was held in December of 2008, and the real issue for the jury to decide in this case, the only issue was this an accident or not? Was it intentional or was it an accident? The state's theory was clearly that this was not an accident. The state's theory was that Ken Huber was a very well-trained law enforcement officer, and well-trained law enforcement officers don't accidentally discharge their weapons. And they attempted to support that theory with expert testimony, as well as several lay witnesses who had known Ken over the years, and say that he was very well qualified. They also offered evidence that Ken was a philandering, abusing reprobate that was the exact kind of person that would do this, given the relationship that he and Pam had, and they proved that through many other acts that they offered, as well as they offered numerous out-of-court statements made by Pam. Now, Mr. Huber's evidence that he had in support that this was an accident was that of a world-renowned scientist from the University of Colorado, Dr. Roger Inoka, who came with empirical studies and data and scientific theories and research regarding unintentional discharges of firearms. Mr. Huber also came with an incident that occurred in the Black Hills just a year earlier of a well-trained law enforcement officer using the exact same weapon involved in this case who had an accidental discharge as determined by our state's DCI. The state was allowed to offer all of their evidence. Mr. Huber didn't get to offer any of his. We've raised five issues on appeal. I'm going to address the first three issues, Mr. Butler, the last two. The first issue is, did the trial court err in allowing John Farnham to testify that this shooting was not consistent with an accident?
If we agree with you that he shouldn't have got to testify, doesn't that weaken your second argument on the rebuttal witness you couldn't get in?
That would entitle us to a new trial. If he never would have testified, and if we get a new trial, then, yeah, you're right, Justice Gilbertson, case over. But there's no way to say that he shouldn't have testified, and then that's harmless, and that we don't get a new trial. Mr. Farnham's testimony was at the heart of what the state's theory was. The state, throughout the case, championed this well-trained officer theory, and Mr. Farnham's testimony that anybody who has been taught to keep their finger in the register position along the barrel of the gun rather than down by the trigger will not accidentally discharge their weapon.
Do we know how he was holding the gun at the time it discharged?
We absolutely do not. And Mr. Farnham admits that, yet the basis for his opinion is that he is that very thing, that Ken was trained to hold his finger alongside there, therefore it wasn't consistent with an accident. But when we asked him, well, did you know how Ken was holding it at the time, he doesn't. So what he does is he makes this leap that simply because he's a well-trained law enforcement officer, that it couldn't have been an accident. And that's where we're challenging this on its foundational reliability grounds.
Well, if that's true, because there's no factual basis, then what about Dr. Inoka's factual basis about loss of balance, startle effect, reactive grip response? There was no evidence of any of that in the record either.
There is evidence that it was an accident. There is evidence of Mr. Huber.
There's no evidence that I saw of loss of balance, the startle effect, or reactive grip response. So if there's no basis for, you're arguing there's no basis for Farnham's testimony, if there's no evidence of these things, then there's no basis for Inoka's testimony.
Well, again, I go back. If Mr. Farnham doesn't testify that this wasn't consistent with an accident, then the state doesn't get that evidence. Then we go back for a new trial, and if it's the court's ruling that neither side gets to put on that evidence, then that's the court's ruling. The thrust of what we're trying to point out here is the unfairness of allowing Mr. Farnham to get up there and simply say, I train law enforcement officers, and they're trained to have their finger along there, and accidents never happen If that's the case.
Well, what would your expert have said ultimately if he had been allowed to, that it was consistent with an accident?
No. He would not have said that he knew whether it was not an accident or not. What he would have offered, first of all, was contradictory evidence to what Farnham said. He would have said that well-trained law enforcement officers have accidental discharges all the time. And just as to go back to your question, it goes against the state's whole theory. I mean, it wasn't just Farnham's testimony. It was the state's whole theory that well-trained law enforcement officers don't have unintentional discharges. Mr. Anoka, Dr. Anoka, had worked in this field for almost 20 years now, specifically with regard to well-trained law enforcement officers still having unintentional discharges. What he could have debunked was this general statement that that doesn't happen. And he would have done that by explaining the scientific things that happen in the human body when a gun goes off.
So he would have given hypothetical scenarios for accidental shootings, even with well-trained officers, but he would never have been able to say that one of those scenarios fits this case.
Exactly. He wouldn't have said, in my opinion, this is what happened in this case. He would have said, these are the different things that could have happened. It was for the jury then to decide whether there were facts that would fit into one of those hypotheticals.
And the daughter never actually sees the gun in Mr. Huber's hand. Is that correct?
She sees it walk out of the room, but at the time it went off, no, she did not.
She was asleep.
Well, no, she wasn't. When she was first interviewed, the idea of her being asleep would never came up. And then by the time we got to trial,
at some place it came up that she was asleep. Now you're saying she said both things.
She said both things. Okay. And what I believe that was is after a year of being interviewed multiple times, it was a way to try and explain her story a little better. Her initial story was not that she was asleep. Her initial story was, my dad walked out of the room, I heard the playing with the safe, and seconds later I heard a gunshot. There was no time window in there for her to be asleep.
You said there was evidence regarding the two beers. I can't remember. Was there any evidence of alcohol in his blood?
No, his PBT came back 0.00.
PBT, but there was no blood test?
No.
Just a breath test.
Just a breath test, okay. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I want to take you back to issue one, since you said that's going to be your area. I think I heard you say you're really talking about fairness. About letting Farnham testify, but not Anoka.
Yes, sir.
So does that mean you really don't have a legal basis to challenge Farnham? I mean, is your real argument fairness that, look, Farnham's in, we should have been able to?
Absolutely not. We have an absolute legal basis, and it's this. It's the Daubert standards. And it's Farnham did not have a sufficiently reliable foundation to make the leap that he made to get to that conclusion. He didn't cite any studies, he didn't cite any literature, he didn't cite any empirical data that would let us know that, hey, if you take these five factors, then you get to a conclusion of accident or non-accident. More importantly, he didn't have any experience in that area. The state champions his experience, but his experience is as a firearm safety trainer. It's not as a accident investigator or a crime scene investigator. He doesn't have any experience in that at all. The only other two times that he testified, it had nothing to do with unintentional discharge. So to say that he has experience in determining, hey, you look at these five things, and that'll tell you I have specialized knowledge. It'll tell me that this is an accident or this is intentional. And so there was no foundation whatsoever for that leap.
Your time has expired. You're hard to stop.
Thank you.
Mr. Butler, you have 8 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. I will, in view of the importance of the issue, I do want to follow up with something on Mr. Sargent's issue. There was the component of the state's case was Mr. Huber is especially well-trained in safety, and he's one heck of a good shot. Mr. Farnham came in and said, if you're properly trained, the odds of that gun going off by accident are astronomical. He just says it, astronomical. He says, in my experience, I've seen it 5 or 6 times. He not only says they're astronomical, he said, for all practical purposes, it isn't going to ever happen. In the final argument, the state then says to the jury, there's no evidence presented by the defense that refutes our case on that point. So insofar as Farnham is allowed to opine based on nothing more than anecdotal experiences and use words like astronomical, we merely said we have a gentleman involved in scientifically based studies that will say 20% of the cases where there's discharge, it's an accident. Officers who have their finger in the right spot of the trigger still do it. He simply would have explained that the foundation, at least one of the foundations of Mr. Farnham's opinion, was wrong. It's not unlike Guthrie. The suicidologist testifies. Well, the defense disputed that. They were allowed to bring in somebody who said, that's all bunk, suicidology. Now, the jury didn't go along with it, and the Supreme Court upheld it, but the point is, the defense had their say. They were allowed to go in and say, this expert doesn't know what he's talking about. The question is one for the jury.
Are we asking, ordinarily we hear from an expert who gives some kind of an alternate opinion or penultimate opinion, but here it seems to me that you're suggesting that the expert can come in and give a series of scenarios and then to ask the jury to tell the jury, well, you pick one if you think one or more might fit. Is that unusual in this case?
I don't agree with the characterization to this extent. When he gets to come in and say it doesn't happen if you put your finger in the right spot and you're trained properly, that's wrong. That's not a true statement. We could have responded to that. Now, they could certainly have cross-examined him and say, well, wait a minute now, you don't have evidence of this here and evidence of that. Sure, that goes, as we often say, to the weight that the jury may accord his testimony, but not its admissibility. The same thing with Farnham. What happened there is we weren't allowed to challenge the weight that the jury should give it. We were simply cut off under the idea that we don't want to confuse the jury. Same thing with the evidence in Meade County. Sure, it was a different situation, I'll grant you that, but that officer was well-trained. He said in the investigation he had his finger in the trigger guard, and he didn't know it went off. And the DCI came back and said that was the result of a sympathetic response, one of the hypotheticals that our expert talked about. In other words, yes, it can happen to well-trained officers, members of the jury. Do we know what happened here? Not necessarily, but should the state be allowed to stay up and say, our case is unrefuted, you can't challenge the opinions of our experts? That wasn't right. And as Justice Sinner noted, if this court were to say Farnham shouldn't have been allowed to do what he did, you're right, that changes the landscape. Now, can the defense go anywhere with that? Our case was largely built on the idea of rebutting what Mr. Farnham was permitted to say. Now, the issue that I have would also address deals with state of mind hearsay testimony. 1916-7, Rule 803-3, a statement of the declarant's then existing state of mind, emotion, sensation, or physical condition, such as intent, plan, motive, design, mental feeling, pain, and bodily health.
Back you up to the other issue. Okay. So in essence, you're saying that the two witnesses rise together or fall together. Either they both should have been on or neither been on. Is that the essence of your argument?
I would say, it's a great question. I'd say I'd go along with it in this respect. If the court's either going to let them both battle it out, the battle of the experts, so to speak, let the jury hear them out, or say no, decided on the facts of the case. Huber was heard to say it was an accident. His daughter, when interviewed, told law enforcement she thought it was an accident. Her first interview. Jurors have to decide then beyond that. But I will grant you that our case for Anoka is considerably diminished if Mr. Farnham is not allowed to do what he did in this case.
Sorry to interrupt. Back to your issue.
In this case, and I put it in the brief, there are over 100 pages of trial transcript, and you'll see it in the brief that we've excerpted this, where one hearsay statement of Pam's after another was read to the jury by virtue of emails. The rule under which they were admitted allows state of mind evidence only. You can't use the evidence to prove the underlying truth of the facts. That is clearly the law. And what happened in this case is they were allowed, and if you read page 62 of the state's brief, you'll get the picture, to use this evidence to prove it was a bad marriage, to prove that Ken had abused her physically and mentally. You can't use that rule for that purpose. It's only as to Pam's state of mind, insofar as Pam's state of mind was relevant to the facts of the case. Did Pam say, I'm afraid? If she had, it's admissible. But when Pam gets up and says, Ken's sitting home depressed, he's drinking too darn much, Ken, 3 years ago, he hit me, according to Nadine, if a statement was made. You can't prove your underlying case through that use of evidence. In the United States versus Brown in front of the D.C. Court of Appeals, it's a case that's been cited by our court a number of times on this very point on Rule 8033. And I take from that this language, in general, where state of mind testimony is sought to be used in an attempt to demonstrate the truth of the underlying facts, rather than to show state of mind, the evidence must be excluded. The court only considered, is it relevant? Period.
But Mr. Miller, I got to stop you right there because there's two steps in the analysis. Yes, it's being used to show a bad marriage, but it's being used to show a bad marriage as a motive to rebut the accident issue.
There is two steps. Step number one, is that evidence relevant? It may be. But can you prove it through a rule of evidence? That's where we get to the next step. I may then say, is it relevant that Mr. Huber verbally abused his wife 5 years ago? We say, well, okay, we'll call that relevant. Now, how can I prove it? Do I get to prove it through state of mind evidence? No, that's not what state of mind evidence is for. You still have to prove it through legitimate means. If the court misapplies a rule, that's an abuse of discretion. So on the one hand, I'm not here to say all of that evidence may not have been relevant, but how they went about it was not proper. You can't use state of mind to prove the underlying truth of the facts. That's the law. Secondly, I wanted to say on this point that the court never went beyond relevance. Now, in their findings of fact, the state proposed for the court, they said the evidence was admissible under the residual hearsay rule. On the record, Judge Anderson said he would not consider the residual hearsay rule, would make no findings regarding guarantees of trustworthiness. The state put it in their findings, and he signed it and now claimed that that was his ruling. He never considered residual hearsay, and that's on the record, and we've cited it, and my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Mr. Blair, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. I find it enlightening, instructional at any time I review a case on appeal to begin by looking at the standard of review. Oftentimes it's a standard review that sets the parameters, the lens, if you will, by which you're going to review a case. And the standard review in this case is an abuse of discretion standard. I know the court is well familiar with the abuse of discretion standard. I've always paraphrased it as whether any judicial mind, taking into account the law and the circumstances of the case, could reasonably reach the same conclusion as a trial court. I think in looking at that standard of review and applying it to all of the issues raised by defense counsel, the state does not feel that any error occurred below. And on those grounds, the state would ask that this court would affirm Mr. Huber's conviction. I think there's been a lot of, comment on the experts and the dueling experts and whether the experts are tied together. I would submit that the only reason the experts are tied together is because of the arguments in defendant's brief. I think you can look at those experts independently and judge whether, I almost said Dr. Farnham, I think we'll give him a promotion, whether Mr. Farnham, his testimony is admissible independent of Dr. Inovis. The three, as I pointed out in my brief, steps to admit expert testimony: is the expert qualified? Is his testimony relevant? And does it rest on a reliable foundation? Defense doesn't challenge, really, that John Farnham is qualified. I know they stood up here and said, well, he's just going to provide this anecdotal evidence. But if you look at the brief and you look at the trial record, they never really challenge whether he was qualified to give testimony on firearms training, accidental discharges. John Farnham has 30 years of experience, and not just handling firearms, but training law enforcement officers how to safely use those firearms. And in that training, he has experienced situations where accidental discharges have occurred. And he used that training and experience, that knowledge. He's wrote books on the subject. He's attended conferences. He's instructed at these conferences. I think it's clear that John Farnham was qualified to give that testimony.
The question really is what What foundation did he have to make the conclusion he made? He says this is not consistent with an accident, and yet he didn't know, and I guess none of us know, how the gun was even being held. We're kind of looking at this as if we're looking at an ideal police officer who's well-trained. They don't make mistakes. But, you know, even good drivers make mistakes. Isn't it conceivable that he was being careless with the gun? And if he was careless with the gun and it went off, that's still not murder.
That's an excellent question, Justice. There is a reliable foundation for Farnham's testimony. And I don't think that Farnham has to actually know how the gun was held to testify in the manner that he did. The foundation for his testimony, he reviewed all of the photos of the crime scene, the reenactment photos. He went to the crime scene. He reviewed the autopsy reports. He reviewed, if I remember correctly, the data from the DCI individuals who measured the distances, the angles, and whatnot. He went, he reviewed the gun. He examined the gun. He used all of that, applied his training and experience, and came up with his conclusion that, in his mind, it was not consistent with an accidental shooting. And I think that is a proper foundation for, I don't want to say a soft science expert. It's hard to wrap the language of Daubert and Guthrie around experts like John Farnham. But we have these types of experts testify all the time. And they don't come to court with piles of data and independent studies that the defense is asking the court to require.
Well, as you're building up the reputation or the qualifications of Farnham, aren't you bringing up along with it the reported error made by the trial court and now allowing the defense to rebut that? As Farnham's evidence becomes more important, doesn't the right to rebut it become more important?
There is an important right to rebut. I would submit that Dr. Anoka was not the expert to do that. I think the point was raised earlier. There is nothing in the record that you can hang Dr. Anoka's testimony on. And I would ask the court to very carefully go back through the hearing record where Dr. Anoka's testimony was proffered and listen to what he says. He is an expert in biomechanics and neurophysiology, the muscle of movement. There is nothing in the record other than the vague statement that this was an accident to hang that testimony on.
But what foundation did he not have that your expert had?
Our expert has
a factual foundation.
Our expert has 30 years of experience in handling.
I'm talking about fact. I mean, I'm talking about what happened at the moment this gun discharged. What more did Mr. Farnham know that Dr. Anoka didn't know?
Well, Dr. Anoka never reviewed any of the file. I believe the testimony was he had a phone conversation with Mr. Sargent, and I think he reviewed some grand jury testimony. He never reviewed any of the photographs, any of the reenactment, any of the like I said, the measurements and whatnot of angles and whatnot. That is the factual underpinning that
neither one of them knew how the gun was being held. No one knows whether he was aiming it, whether he was holding it, whether he was fumbling with it. We don't know.
I would say that there's only one person that knows how that gun was being held at the time it discharged, and that's the defendant. And that brings up another point I wanted to make. Judge Anderson specifically said, all I am asking is that you give me some to the defense, and I'm paraphrasing, I know. All I am asking is that you give me something to hang Dr. Anoka's testimony on. Put something in the record as to what was occurring in that hallway, whether he slipped and fell, whether he was fumbling with the safe. Put something in the record, and then I will give you the whole deal.
Well, as Justice Kogan said, what was there about Farnham that tamed his testimony on?
I would submit that it's the...
accident, something in the hallway, a trip. There's nothing for him to hang his testimony on.
Well, no, and I think that's why he's saying it's not consistent with an accidental shooting. There was nothing that Mr. Farnham saw, no evidence of a trip, no evidence of a fumbling. I think he pointed out that the defendant was in his own home, in a relatively relaxed atmosphere, and these are the things that he looked at and allowed the jury to draw the inference, well, okay, you're in your own home, you're in a relaxed atmosphere, you're a well-trained officer, that was the state's theory. We never claim that accidental discharges never happened with well-trained officers, but John Farnham looked at each of those facts along with the file that he reviewed, and I think that's the factual underpinning for his testimony that Dr. Anoka simply didn't have. His expertise was in muscle movement and was nothing to hang that on in the record. This other bunch of evidence that the defendant claims, defense counsel claims was rebuttal evidence, Dr. Inopa is not an expert in that area.
So wasn't the trial court's logic basically saying to Mr. Huber, Mr. Huber, if you give up your right to remain silent and get on the stand and testify as to certain foundational evidence, then I'll let your expert in. If not, your expert doesn't testify.
That is exactly what he said. He said, unfortunately, there was only one witness who could provide the foundational testimony necessary.
Well, you're assuming that he could know it, too. I mean, you know, I'm no expert in gun safety or shooting, or I'm not even an expert with a hammer and a nail, but, you know, I think about that simple analogy of, you know, I take a hammer and I hit a nail, I tend to hit the nail and I miss and hit my thumb. And now, I can't explain how I missed the nail. I'm not sure how I missed the nail. I aimed at it, I looked at it, I brought the hammer down, and I thought I was going to hit the nail. Instead, I hit my thumb. Didn't the judge in this case require Mr. Huber to come up with the scientific, physiological explanation for why the gun went off, when the only one who really could give an explanation is the expert? I mean, policemen have accidents with guns, and maybe they don't know why the gun went off. That's why we have people like Dr. Inopa who do these empirical studies.
I don't think he would require the defendant to give the scientific explanation. He is requiring the defendant to give the necessary foundational prerequisite for the scientific testimony. I was in the hallway and I slipped on a toy, and that's what happened. And then the gun just went off, and I don't know. And then then you have the proper evidentiary foundation to allow Inopa to come in and say.
But that assumes that he knew. I mean, that assumes that he knew what he was doing precisely that caused the gun to go off. And what I'm suggesting isn't it a possibility that we don't always know what exactly we did, what mechanism we did in order to have an accident? That's maybe, by essence, what an accident is.
I would agree to the extent that we don't always know what we do to have an accident, but I think you still could give the proper foundational testimony to say, I was in the hallway, and I was holding the gun, and I was trying to open the safe, and then it just went off. You know, there's testimony of the clicks and beeps, and it's theorized that they were trying to open the safe, but the safe door wasn't open when law enforcement got there. Nobody knows whether he was actually trying to open the safe. The point is that you needed that foundational testimony to hang Dr. Inopa's muscle scientific testimony on. And then there's something the jury can hang that testimony on and say, okay, so we have testimony, he's in a hallway, he was fumbling with the safe door. Again, that's not on the record, but, you know, hypothetically, let's say that's what the testimony was. And then the expert got up and said, well, when you're doing that, and let's say the gun starts to slip out of your hand, you squeeze it hard. Or you reach with one hand while you're holding the gun in the other hand, and maybe you squeeze both at the same time. Then you would have had that foundational prerequisite, and then the explanation from the expert of what the science actually is. I don't think the trial court erred in saying, I need that foundational prerequisite. I think that each side in a trial is always put in this situations where they have to make tactical decisions. The tactical decision here was the defense needed to present that foundational testimony, and unfortunately the only person that could do it is the defendant. Do we put the defendant on the stand to put that foundational testimony in so Dr. Inopa could testify, or do we try and attack it through, get it in through cross-examination of John Farnham and Seth Bradbury and things of those natures? I think it was a tactical decision by the defense. All the trial court did was say, I need some foundation before, under the rule of law, I can let this expert testify. His evidence has to be relevant to the record and not just pure speculation, leaving the jury to conjecture about, well, and I think the point was made earlier, it would have been, maybe it was this. The expert also testified to this, well, maybe it was this, well, maybe it was that. You would have just been inviting the jury to speculate, leading to confusion. You needed that foundational testimony in order to hang Dr. Inopa's testimony on. Once you don't have that, the rebuttal of Dr. Inopa, he's not an expert in firearms. Contrary to what Mr. Butler and Mr. Sargent claimed in their reply brief, I don't believe he's the world expert in accidental discharges. Once you get past his biomechanics and neurophysiology background, He has almost no experience with firearms. If you look closely at his testimony, and I believe the mid-90s, he was asked by Arizona, a law enforcement agency, to theorize what causes his accidental discharges. He did no studies. He theorized based on his neurophysiology background, and I'm not just debating that it's a sound theory, but he's fired a firearm once, I believe, at Quantico with the FBI, and other than that, he has no experience with firearms. He has anecdotal experience with accidental discharges. But again, if the trial court would have allowed that in rebuttal, it would have been just anecdotal evidence that he has no, he never studied it. He might have been there. He might have watched a video of it. It might have been the facts of a case that he was testifying on. It was outside the breadth of his experience, his expertise, the rebuttal evidence was.
Doesn't that go more to the weight of his testimony rather than to its admissibility, especially in light of the advantage the state then took of it in the final argument where they say the defense, they have nothing to challenge Farnham?
But to go back, you have to go back and focus on what the trial court was reviewing at the time Judge Anderson made the decision to admit or deny the testimony. And I think, again, I can't read Judge Anderson's mind, but from the reading the transcript, it looks like I don't have the foundational testimony for your expertise, and you know, I'm not going to allow you up to rebut area that's outside your expertise. Experts are not supposed to be put on the stand to testify to stuff that they're not experts in. And I think if you would have said, well, I'm going to let Dr. Noki get on the stand to testify about this rebuttal evidence, the trial court would have been erring in allowing an expert to get on the stand and testify outside the area of his expertise. He's not qualified to give an expert opinion on those facts. He's qualified to give an expert opinion on human muscle movement and how that affects accidental discharge. I think when you look at the two together, Farnham was clearly qualified, his testimony was relevant, and he had a reliable methodology and foundation that underlied his testimony.
But you know, Judge Anderson found that Anoka was reliable and that there was a scientific basis for his opinion.
Judge Anderson, you're right. The one area where Dr. Anoka's testimony was tripped up was he wasn't relevant. Again, it's that foundational evidence that makes his testimony relevant. Facts in the record that then makes his testimony regarding human movement and the theories behind that relevant to the case. And there were no facts in the record other than the blanket, it was an accident statement. And so that's where Judge Anderson denied the testimony. I think Dr. Noka is clearly qualified to talk about neurophysiology and biomechanics. His testimony simply was not relevant without that foundational evidence. One other point on the experts before I try and move on to the hearsay. In the defendant's brief, defense counsel appears to try to establish this requirement that experts have, you know, these datas and studies. And I think our court has recognized, and courts all across the country have recognized, that you just cannot apply Daubert to all experts. There are experts that are going to be able to testify that, you know, they just don't have reams and reams of data or studies behind them. A general contractor with 30 years of experience that is then hired in a civil lawsuit to review what happened to a home, I think if you read the defense counsel's theory far enough out, you would then have to require that general contractor to come up with data and then some sort of study that he either did or was done somewhere else before you can testify. And that's never been the law. The hard sciences, the U.S. Supreme Court and our court has recognized, yes, you need to take a hard look at them because immediately juries, lay people put great stock in an expert, and especially hard sciences experts. And that's where I think Daubert came from. That's what they were trying to drive in there, that you need to put these people under greater scrutiny, especially considering the stock that juries give them. But you can't apply that in all cases. I think there's one quote, and at this point I forget what case it came from, but there are as many ways to qualify an expert as there are experts. And I think that's exactly true. And the hyper-technical reading of Guthrie and Daubert that you need to have data and studies for all experts, I think, is just falls in carrying the case law too far. Now, on the hearsay statements, I would say the court doesn't even need to reach the state of mind exception. I think that defense counsel has never adequately challenged the residual exception. I know he claims, they claim that, well, Judge Anderson never made oral comments on the indicia of reliability and whatnot on the record oral. But those findings of facts were proposed. I know in my review of the record of the file in my office, they were sent out as proposed findings of facts. I am unsure whether that letter made it into the record, so, you know, please perhaps review that point. And I'm assuming defense counsel received those and had a chance to respond to them and object to them if they wanted to. I'm also assuming that Judge Anderson read those, and his signature on them means he agreed with what was in them.
Because he specifically said he wasn't going to rule on it. And then he does rule on it, you know, and so there's maybe not true, but I mean, there's sort of the suggestion here that counsel just slipped it under his desk and he signed it without really considering it or reading it. And, you know, that's, I'm not saying that happened. We just don't know what happened.
And I guess I don't recall the hearing, that testimony from the hearing transcripts, him saying, I am not going to rule on the residual exception. He ruled on the state of mind, and I think Judge Anderson felt that was enough to deal with orally at that time. You know, this case had dragged on for many, many months, many, many hearings, many postponements. He was in an effort to try and speed things up to get to trial. I mean, he was unfortunately just orally dealing with that issue by saying, I've made the findings on the record that I need to make. And then when it was proposed to him through the proposed findings of fact, which were also argued in the state's motion. It wasn't like, you know, we slipped this in at the last second. It was in the state's motion, the residual exception. It was argued to Judge Anderson. He just didn't make oral findings on them, but the written findings are the ones that can control over any oral findings on the record. I think the residual exception, all of those statements are allowed underneath it. I think if you look at the state of mind evidence, I think the state of mind exception does apply, and the trial court did not err in ruling that way. It appears my time is almost up. Is there any other question?
Thank you, Mr. Blair. Great, Mr. Sargent, you have 7 minutes, sir.
I'd like to follow up on what Justice Zinder pointed out. Judge Anderson found Dr. Anoka's testimony to be valid, found him to be exceptionally qualified, and his testimony to be based on good science. What he ruled was that his testimony wasn't relevant. That was a misapplication of a rule of evidence. Clearly, given Mr. Farnham's testimony, Dr. Anoka's testimony was relevant. And that misapplication of the rule of evidence by Judge Anderson is an abuse of discretion. That's what this court has said, that if a trial court misapplies a rule of evidence, that is an abuse of discretion. That's what we have here. Mr. Farnham, the crux of his testimony, the crux of the foundation that he said clearly was his only foundation at the Daubert hearing, was that Ken Huber was a well-trained law enforcement officer taught to keep his finger in the register position. Dr. Anoka has done studies, has had his studies validated by empirical research, that keeping your finger in the register position does not cause the body to not involuntarily contract or involuntarily touch the trigger. The Heim studies at Frankfurt University confirmed that. That was empirical data that shows law enforcement officers, even when they're told not to do it, still will do it. Now, going back to Farnham's testimony and whether it was based on a reliable foundation, he never once explained, other than to explain the register position, why he thought that this wasn't consistent with an accident. If you go back and look at the record, he says, well, he was in familiar surroundings. Well, what data, literature, or experience did he show that makes familiar surroundings relevant as to whether it's an accident or not? He also talked about the fact that there was a narrow window of opportunity, and somehow that makes this more or less likely an accident. Yet again, he didn't provide any explanation for how or why that makes this more or less likely an accident. What Anoka could have provided, in addition to his rebuttal on the register position issue, was also he could have provided the same thing that the evidence out in Meade County could have provided. That yes, there are specific instances where law enforcement officers unintentionally discharge their weapons. And they do it sometimes in situations where you wouldn't believe where the bullet ends up. Dr. Anoka would have testified that he's worked on cases where a law enforcement officer in a known accidental situation was walking up to a vehicle and suffered an accidental discharge that hit the passenger right in the cheek. He would have testified that he was involved in another case where a burglar jumped from a window to a tree while officers were walking up to a house, and the officer experienced an unintentional discharge and shot the man right in the head. Marksmen tried for months to replicate it. They couldn't. This would have went right to what the state said in its closing argument. The state stood up and said, ladies and gentlemen, there's accidental discharges with Glocks, but there's not a single shred of evidence in this record that shows that it ever hits anybody. I mean, it goes in the ceiling or it goes in the ground. But it never hits somebody in the head, like in this case. Dr. Anoka would have cut that off at the pass. And that was what was so prejudicial in all of this, was the state's ability.
Did Judge Anderson know that you were intending to have Dr. Anoka testify about those two scenarios?
Absolutely.
And where is that in the record?
It would have been part of the summary that we would have made. That's attached as the appendix. And it would have been brought up also in the hearing on November 19th, 2008.
Thank you.
The quality of this evidence in rebutting Farnham and in closing off the state from making that type of argument and close was certainly prejudicial, certainly denied Ken Huber his right to a fair trial. If the court doesn't have any other questions on these issues, I'll yield the rest of my time to Mr. Butler, if that's okay. Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Butler.
I think that the fundamental part of the problem here with Judge Anderson's view of accidental discharge is he's treating it like an affirmative defense. Unless the defense can come forward affirmatively with some evidence, I'm not going to let you get into it with an expert. The question's been asked here, what did Farnham know that Mr. Anoka didn't know? Farnham had no more information. Ken Huber yelled out it was an accident. The daughter said she thought it looked like an accident, although she didn't see it, but she was asked for perception of the events in the room. That's all we know for sure. Now, the court said that's good enough to let Farnham come in and just say, I looked everything over, and it's not consistent with an accident, folks. And then he says the odds of it discharging accidentally are astronomical. Now, if you want to get up and say, we don't need data, we don't need studies to prove his opinion up. When you make a statement about the odds of something being astronomical, shouldn't you have to back it up with something? What did he back it up with? 30 years I've taught gun safety, and I say the odds are astronomical. We simply had scientific evidence that would contradict that statement. This court has said there's a fundamental right to put on a defense if you can reasonably connect the evidence to your theory of the case. It doesn't have to be absolute. Can you connect it? We sure could. Provided their theory of the case is the odds are astronomical, Ken Huber would accidentally discharge that case. And they did stand in front of the jury and they used that phrase. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you heard our experts say it's astronomical and the defense hasn't answered that claim. That's just wrong. I mean, let the jury hear both sides or don't let them hear either side of the thing. With regard to the issue of the hearsay statements, what I just heard here is completely contrary to what occurred at the motion hearing. If you look on the June 6th motion hearing transcript, page 153 and 154, Judge Anderson says, I'm admitting the hearsay statements under 803.3 because it's a firmly rooted exception. Therefore, I'm not going to consider whether it's admissible as residual hearsay, which would have required him to make record findings that the evidence was reliable. He chose not to do that. He made it quite clear on the record. Now, the state will tell you, since they got it in the findings and he signed it and the defense didn't do anything about it, we win. You know, Justice Konenkamp, I read a couple times your writings in the Krebs decision that came out in February about when judges decide we're going to turn over fact-finding writing to lawyers. If you're going to do that, you need to be careful. In the Krebs case, one of the concerns you had was the exaggerated representations made in the finding that appeared to contradict what the judge had said himself. This goes one step past that. This is coming up and putting in something the judge expressly said, I'm not going to rule on. You may as well have a judge stand up and say, I'm ordering this, and then if the lawyer can get something else in there, past the judge, past co-counsel on the other side, he wins. That can't be the way we encourage things to be done.
But you know, Mr. Butler, we've often written that the judge can change his mind between the time of the oral statement, the time of the hearing, and the time everything's finalized with the findings of fact and conclusions of law. And how do we know that's not what happened here?
Shouldn't we know for sure? I mean, when the judge says on the record, I'm not going to make any findings, we were never then provided any opportunity to address the issue in court. That was what the purpose of the hearing was. If we were going to get into indicia of reliability, well, he said, no, we're not going to get into it because I'm not going to consider it.
But you had the opportunity to object to the proposed findings on the residual hearsay.
That's correct. Okay. And I'm saying what happened here is this judge signed something that totally contradicted his bench ruling, that he wasn't going to consider that evidentiary exception. And now we engage in the legal fiction of just saying, let's all just assume Judge Anderson changed his mind.
Why didn't you raise that to him?
I can't give you an answer to that as I stand here today. At what point, when those findings were coming in through this process, do I want to look at that and say, Mike Butler, you messed up because you didn't read their findings and realize what they did? Guilty. Absolutely, 100% guilty. I'll take the fall for that. I didn't catch it at the time. I knew what his ruling was. Later on when I saw it, I knew it was a mistake. So at some point down the road, I may have to say that under oath, but I'll be glad to do it because that was clearly not what the judge said. It was never argued by us. We never had a chance to respond to it. And if I missed it in the findings, that's my fault. Thank you very much. My time is up. We ask for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.